Bollinger versus Lillo.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is David Rizumna, and I represent Diana Lillo, who's with me in court this morning, and I wish to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Proceed.
Your Honors, when a condominium seller completes the statutorily required seller disclosure statement, what's colloquially known as a Form 17, her obligation is to disclose material defects that are within her actual knowledge concerning the property. The term "the property" is a defined term in the Form 17 that Ms. Lilla completed prior to listing her condominium for sale. And the Form 17 defines the property as Unit 31, which is the unit that she's selling. So in tandem with the seller's disclosure regarding any known defects regarding the unit, a condominium association has an obligation to complete what's known as a resale certificate in the case of a previously occupied condominium, or a public offering statement if it's a newly constructed condominium.
There are questions in that form about whether you're in a homeowners association, which would be a condominium, aren't there?
There are. I'm not suggesting that that it's an either-or proposition. A seller of a condominium completes the Form 17. The HOA, in tandem with that, completes the resale certificate. So it's not that a seller would have to, that only one of those two disclosures are made. Those go hand in hand.
Aren't there questions on the Form 17 that ask about parts of the building that aren't within the unit boundaries? To question 10 in particular, it asks sellers to disclose any other existing material defects affecting the property that a prospective buyer should know about. Wouldn't a defect in other parts of the condominium affect Unit 31?
I think in disclosing any other defects in the property, Your Honor, you'd have to...
Any other existing material defects affecting the property?
Yeah, I think that it's to the extent that a defect in a common area would have an impact on a particular unit. There are parts of the Form 17 that talk about areas other than the unit itself.
Well, so doesn't that defeat your argument that she wins because she disclosed everything she knew about her unit?
I am happy to move on to other aspects of the argument if that is not persuasive to Your Honor. I think that if you look at the average experience of a layperson, this is before litigation or attorneys get involved, who's trying to fill out a form, I think that, sure, there are parts of the Form 17 that deal with areas beyond just Unit 31. And for the purposes of this appeal, I think that it doesn't necessarily turn on whether you're looking at just within the four walls of the condominium. I am pointing it out, though, because it was raised to the trial court, and it's important to look at the Form 17 from the perspective of an average buyer who's doing the best they can. When Mr. Bollinger, prior to making his offer, walked through the property, he was told by the real estate agent who was holding the open house that the deck had suffered significant water intrusion, but that the deck had been fixed, which is true. And that's at RP 642, Mr. Bollinger's own testimony. He made no further inquiries regarding, what was the nature of the water damage? How extensive was it? What other areas might have been affected by this water damage? His offer to purchase was itself contingent, as Your Honors know, on his subjective satisfaction with an inspection. His inspector, who he accompanied on the inspection, stated to him, observed that there was a siding missing from the front of the condominium, not anywhere near Unit 31, but that there was siding missing. And the inspector specifically advised Mr. Bollinger that he should talk to the HOA about why that is, and that Mr. Bollinger should also inquire of the owner whether what the nature of the repairs were that had recently occurred, and and whether there were any other types of warranties or issues in this case, which Mr. Bollinger admits that he never did. The inspector also urged Mr. Bollinger, who was represented by Foster Pepper during the purchase of the condo, and I point that out because that I don't think that's the typical situation in a residential purchase situation where somebody is represented by legal counsel. Usually, or often, it's a real estate agent, if that. And so Mr. Bollinger was told by the inspector to review meeting minutes from the last couple of board meetings and HOA meetings, and had Mr. Bollinger heeded that advice, he would have seen the April 27, 2009 meeting minutes, which are contained in several locations, but including at CP 972, that disclosed specifically the items that Mr. Bollinger has sued Ms. Lilla for not disclosing to him. When Mr. Bollinger signed the acknowledged receipt of the resale certificate, so this is now the disclosure document from the HOA, disclosing what the financial profile of the condominium complex is, Mr. Bollinger was advised that there is no reserve study, that the condominium association had not yet had a reserve study. Mr. Bollinger, I pointed out in the brief and in reply, was very candid to say that that he understood those risks. There was an exhibit which was at CP 931 where Mr. Bollinger said, you know, I'm concerned about the low reserves in this case and in this condominium. I suppose I'll have to budget about $5,000 in order to plan for any expenses that might arise. And so I think just like in the Dalarna case in particular, where there was a misunderstanding by the buyer as to what the size of the risk was, that this case is comparable to that, because Mr. Bollinger evidenced an actual awareness of what it meant to be buying into a condominium association. He knew the age of the building as well.
Can I ask you this? You mentioned the missing sighting that the inspector noticed during his report, and then you said that the inspector told Mr. Bollinger that he should definitely ask about the missing sighting.
Yes.
And where is that in the record, or what exactly did he say?
May I just respond, Your Honor? That's at, I believe, RP 636, and then if you look at clerk's papers at 890 to 895 is the inspection.
All right, thank you.
The report. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jay Carlson, and I'm here representing the respondent, John Bollinger. I guess I'll start where you left off, Your Honor, and point out that I encourage you to look closely at the inspection report that was repeatedly referred to as having these clear instructions to my client, to Mr. Bollinger, to talk to the owner about the problems with the deck, talk to the owner about the missing siding, check with the HOA about the missing siding. None of that is accurate. There is a single sentence that notes in a consideration issue, not an action issue, and the report's divided up into two things, and this is Trial Exhibit 63. In a consideration issue, there's a single line that says, I saw some missing siding, check CCRs. That's all it says. CCRs are the conditions, covenants, and restrictions applicable to a condo. You know, if Mr. Bollinger had read the CCRs, the CCRs had nothing to do with disclosing any defect with the condominium and the huge envelope study that was going on that Ms. Lilla knew about and intentionally failed to disclose. So if you look at the exhibit he refers to, it nowhere provides a specific instruction that you need to follow up with the owner or the HOA about this missing siding.
Does that really matter? Isn't the question more, does the missing siding put him on notice to inquire about whether it is representative of a defect, which then is buyer beware?
Well, I think that
There's a recent decision of this court that seems kind of draconian, but on that notice issue.
Well, except that what is it notice of? That there's missing siding somewhere
notice
far away from
notice, maybe to take a look because it's
well, but the inquiry notice under all of the cases is notice of the defect complained of. There's no evidence in the record that that missing siding has anything to do with the defect complained of. There's no evidence in the record that it was part of the envelope study. They've latched on to a single sentence in an inspection report that there was some missing siding, but there's no showing that that was related to the defect, notice of the defect. And, you know, I think it's important that inquiry notice has to have some substantial relationship to the defect complained of. So the arguments, for example, well, he should have checked the HOA meeting minutes. Well, there's no notice of any defect that requires him to go check the HOA meeting minutes, and there's certainly no freestanding legal obligation on a buyer to check HOA meeting minutes in a vacuum. And if they don't, they lose out on their remedy for an intentional misrepresentation. I think it's important to go back to the standard of review in this case because, you know, there was a full trial on the merits, and then there was a separate second hearing on damages. And Judge Canova entered detailed factual findings on all of these issues, including the issue of inquiry notice. None of those factual findings were challenged on appeal. And there's very clear case law, including the Roble case, where the state Supreme Court has said, if you don't challenge factual findings, they're verities. So there's a failure here to even put these issues properly before the court. There's also, frankly, even if you apply the substantial evidence standard, which is the standard that applies if factual findings are properly preserved for appeal, there's clearly substantial evidence in the record, both, you know, from the hundreds of pages of testimony and the many exhibits. Let's remember, Ms. Lilla was in charge of this issue at her condominium complex. So she was just, you know, the idea that she was some, you know, innocent seller who didn't really understand what she was doing, she was very assertively and aggressively in charge of this issue, and she put herself in that position for the condominium because she was dissatisfied with how others were dealing with it. If you look at the record that was before Judge Canova, there's communications from her directly where she's saying to people, shh, don't say anything about the inspection that occurred because I'm trying to sell my condo. She says that there's no marketability of the condo now with this problem. She says that in her own words. Yet when it came time to fill out the Form 17, she utterly, and it seems clear, intentionally failed to disclose what she knew about the problems with the condominium. So you have unchallenged factual findings of Judge Canova that dispose of the issue of whether there was inquiry notice, and also disposes of the issue of were there misrepresentations, were they material, was his reliance on them reasonable, and did it affect the outcome.
Can I ask you to address the issue of whether there is sufficient evidence that the concealed defect presents a danger to property, health, or life?
So that falls under the fraudulent misrepresentation claim. In the case law, there's a discussion under fraudulent misrepresentation.
Concealment also.
That's right. That's what I mean, fraudulent concealment. Excuse me. But keep in mind that the discussion in those cases has to do with the economic loss rule. So the economic loss rule, when it's applied, says you can't have a tort claim for damages that are related specifically to the property. If it's related specifically to the property, you're limited to contract claims because you had a purchase and sale agreement for that property.
True enough, but when the court is discussing the tort claim of fraudulent concealment, it does mention that as being one of the elements, danger to property, health, or life.
Yes, but if
and
you...
That's what I'm asking you about, because the trial court did conclude that that element was proven, and now the question is there substantial evidence to support that?
I would actually argue as a matter of law that here where the parties contracted for tort remedies in the purchase and sale agreement, which is an option that you have now in purchase and sale agreements because of DeLarna and the other economic loss cases. When they do that, it takes it outside the economic loss rule.
I'm not concerned about the economic loss rule. Okay, I'm looking at this as a tort claim. You would agree, I take it, that one of the elements of the tort claim of fraudulent concealment is danger. Danger to property, health, or life.
And actually,
do you agree or not?
I disagree. Right. I believe that if you're not in the economic loss context, if you have an economic loss rule problem, then you have to find some other damage to health, life, a threat of some sort that's outside the property. But if you contract around the economic loss rule, I actually don't think it's an element anymore. That element only exists.
Are you saying it's not even a tort claim?
No, I believe it is a tort claim, but I believe that...
Isn't there, there's always an element of damage in a tort claim, isn't
it? Yes, but if you...
And is it not the case under the language of Alejandre that the particular type of damage you have to show is damage to property, health, or life of the purchaser?
I'm just going to repeat the same answer. Because Alejandre was looking at it in the context of it, the economic loss rule applies, so what do you have to show to have the claim to take it outside of the economic loss rule?
So what kind of damage do you have to prove?
Here, just damage to his financial interest in owning the property. In other words, a defect that required a remedy that cost him money.
And your authority for that is?
Just looking at the analysis of the Alejandre and the other cases, it discussing that element of a fraudulent concealment claim.
And besides Alejandre, do you have any particular cases in mind?
I think it's implicit in all of those cases. I don't have the names of the cases in front of me, but I do believe that that's how that element came into the discussion in the cases, was solely because of the economic loss rule, and here they've contracted around it. You know, I think it is very important to apply the doctrine that fact findings that are unchallenged are verities on appeal. It's been very difficult to prepare the response and for this hearing today because the approach has changed over time to the defense of the case. The trial, the approach was, well, she didn't know anything. That was proven to be clearly not true. So the first brief, the argument was, well, there's no legal duty because of this definitional issue with defining a condominium. And I think we very persuasively in response showed, no, definitionally, it's very clear that condominium ownership, condominium property, has two elements, common ownership and unit ownership, and that both of those are required for disclosure in the statute. Now the argument seems to be, well, even if she misrepresented, it's his problem because he was on constructive notice of defects because of this missing siding. And I would argue that if you look at the cases, including the recent cases, the Vitter case, when constructive notice is found, it's because there is specific notice of some sort provided of the actual defect complained of. I've seen no case where something is attenuated as missing siding in another part of the building with no further information about what the siding refers to, why it's there, could be held to provide constructive notice for what turned out to be this defect with water intrusion and the siding. So that's, I think, a bridge too far in terms of constructive notice in these cases. Judge Canova held a full trial, made findings, their verities. We ask you to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. We have 3 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Of course, Ms. Lilly isn't just relying on the fact that there was siding missing that Mr. Bollinger and his inspector noted, but also the fact that he was told of the recent deck repair. Now, Judge Applewick, I believe you authored the Vissers case, and I think that's the one that you were alluding to. And the reason I filed that as a statement in my supplemental statement of authority is because I think that this case, the result in this case, is absolutely irreconcilable with that Vissers case as well as with the other cases that I cited in my opening brief and in my reply. And the reason I like the Vissers case is because we don't need to worry about the part of what Ms. Lilla knew or didn't know. And I'm willing to assume for the purposes of these arguments, I mean, in Vissers, you had a truly evil seller. I mean, somebody who actively covered something up. There's been no response from counsel at any point to, first of all, negligent misrepresentation cannot be based on an omission alone. It is agreed in this case that the Form 17 was the only communication that occurred between Ms. Lilla and Mr. Bollinger regarding this property. And what he's claiming is that she omitted certain information. There's been no coherent answer then on the fraudulent concealment matter, particularly in light of the case law that says if you are going to allege damage to property or risk of damage to property as part of your damage element of fraudulent concealment, it can't be damage to the property itself. It would have to be like a collapsing roof that then damages other things inside of a location or life is obviously risk to life is obviously in its own category. Your Honors, the very items that the that Mr. Bollinger points to that to support his proposition that, you know, look at Ms. Lilla, she had this awareness that the condo wasn't marketable because of these problems, that all had to do with issues pertaining to her deck back in 2007 when she first wanted to list her property for sale. She realized that there was no action from the board. She wasn't able, that her condo wasn't marketable until her deck got fixed. That's when she decided to take the initiative and spearheaded the effort to repair her deck. As part of that effort, it revealed problems in the decks above her and below her, and those were all fixed. At the time that Mr. Bollinger made his offer, the one thing we know for sure is that every deck in stack one and the siding adjacent to, around, above, and underneath unit 31 was absolutely watertight. There might have been problems with other areas of the condo, but that's where it becomes relevant that Mr. Bollinger says is not that Ms. Lilla knew the results of the envelope inspection, but because he acknowledges that she did not. That wasn't revealed to the homeowners until after Ms. Lilla was no longer a homeowner. What he says is that she knew of the risks of potential problems with other decks based on her experience with her own deck. Well, that's all information that could have been revealed had Mr. Bollinger asked a couple of follow-up questions. We asked for fees on appeal. We asked that Judge Canova's findings, judgment be reversed, and I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you.